Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams. Dr. Williams is the author of the acclaimed book, Shattered by the Darkness, Putting the Pieces Back Together After Child Abuse. Dr. Williams is on the senior leadership team at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. And Dr. Williams travels the United States speaking and training professionals, parents, and victims about the importance of dealing with abuse and personal trauma head-on and not being afraid to break the silence of your own personal pain. Feel free to call in to tonight's show at 888-627-6008 and speak with Dr. Williams and his guests live on air. And now, your host, Dr. Williams.
All right. Thank you, Douglas, and welcome to a brand new year, 2020, and welcome to Breaking the Silence with Dr. Greg Williams. I'm just Greg tonight, and we're going to have a great program, and I'm looking forward to 2020 being the best year ever that we have had, and me personally, and hopefully you too. And we're going into not only a new year, but a brand new decade. So I'm just all pumped, and we have so many exciting things that's just around the corner that we wanted to get you all involved in, and hope that you're excited about it as what I am. But just welcome to the program. Grab you a cup of coffee, but you want to make sure that you grab a notepad, a pen or a pencil. We're going to give you some things that we want you to jot down and maybe be able to go and research and look in some websites and things of that order also. So if you have an opportunity sometime this evening, you may want to jump on the Facebook, Shattered by the Darkness Facebook page, and look and watch the new video that my son just posted a few days ago. So, Curtis, thank you for doing that. He's the one that has all the intelligence. I just talk about it. He's the one that actually has it. But the video is just a short little minute video about the new book that's going to be coming out shortly called Overcoming the Darkness, The Roadmap to Hope, and working hard on that. And it's just kind of an intro video about that, and just letting people know what to expect as it's coming around the corner. And I think it's going to be cutting edge book. It's not going to just be a book that you read. It's going to be a book that you'll be able to have your phone next to you and scan on certain pages, and I will come alive on your phone, and we'll have video trainings, we'll have audio trainings, we'll have some of these programs integrated inside the book. So it's just going to be a multi-technical, cutting-edge book that I'm very excited about, and hopefully here in the next month or two or three, it depends on how fast we can get this out and all these videos made to put inside the book. But go in there and look at it and check it out, that little video, and see what you think about it. And love for you to share that, comment, post it, pass it on Shattered by the Darkness Facebook account. It's on the webpage. It's also on the Instagram page at Shattered by the Darkness. So would love to have you be part of that. I hope you had an awesome Christmas. And I hope as you go into the new year, you are geared up for something new and exciting. And I was going to give a little some tips, but I may wait till next week to do that. But just want to let you know, don't expect this year to be perfect, because life isn't perfect. But all we can expect, and I'll just throw this out, is for you to be a perfect example of a human being and how we need to care and love and embrace other people and their own situations. And let's just make this year the best year yet. And it's in you, and there's always hope. No matter what 2019 happened to you and what you went through, 2020, that's in the past. 2020 is a new year. So let's just turn the new page, and you have an opportunity for a fresh start. And let's make it a good one. Tonight, I'm looking forward to our guest. And if you want to call in and comment, understand that we do have a licensed clinical psychologist with us tonight. There will not be medical advice given if you decide to call in. So we try not to do that. We will give you tips and thoughts and opinions, but we will not give specific medical advice. But we'd love to have your comments and questions, and the phone number to call in live, and Douglas will talk to you a little bit before he puts you onto the show. 888-627-6008. And it is an honor tonight. When I found out that Dr. Julie Kaplow was going, that agreed to be on the program tonight, I talked to everybody that I could at Baylor and to invite them to listen in tonight in Texas Children's Hospital. Matter of fact, I reached out to Dr. Kloppen this week, the CEO of Baylor College of Medicine, and he gave me some great words about Dr. Kaplow. And I also reached out to Mark Wallace, the CEO, the head of Texas Children's Hospital, and he did the same about how great this individual is. And I'm hoping my boss, Dr. Michael Belfort, and Dr. Ferris are listening too tonight, just because it's an honor. And I think Dr. Kaplow, when we bring her on here just in a second, is going to also underline and highlight too that it is an honor not only to be part of Baylor College of Medicine, which I truly believe is the best college of medicine in the country, if not the world. Texas Children's Hospital is one of the best hospitals, not only in our area, not only in the state, but in the country and possibly the world. It's an honor to be a part of both of those institutions. And the neat thing about the way we work is that Baylor College of Medicine not only treats patients, but we have some of the best doctors, but we also train the upcoming doctors and the residencies and the fellowships. And Dr. Julie Kaplow is part of that. So it's just an honor to be part of, and I'm just a paper pusher. I'm not important at all at Texas Children's or Baylor College of Medicine. I just push papers. But Dr. Kaplow is a licensed clinical psychologist, a board-certified clinical child and adolescent in adolescent psychology. She holds an appointment as an associate professor, head of psychology, a vice chair for the Behavioral Health and Department of Pediatrics at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, and she is also the director of the Texas Children's Trauma and Grief Center, which we're going to talk about in major way tonight. And she also is, she serves as chief of psychology at Texas Children's Hospital, and she is just has some wisdom that I really want to dig into tonight, and she is offering her brain up tonight, and I'm just going to see how much I can scrape out of there and apply to mine. So, Dr. Kaplow, it is an honor to have you with us for Breaking the Silence. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be on the show.
You know, I tell you what, I only made it through about four sentences of your bio, because if I finished it, the hour would be over. It's quite impressive, though. And I just appreciate, I remember having the opportunity to sit down and talk with you. I think it was about a year ago now, when my first book was coming out, and you were so kind to help me out and give me some advice and wisdom. And I just appreciate you, and this is going to be fun. Tell me in a nutshell, I kind of just went through the official intro, but tell me just a little bit about yourself and what you are passionate about, what your life is going to be all about in 2020, and what you're doing not only at Baylor and not only at Texas Children's, but what you're literally doing around the country. Just let me inside of your world just in the next few minutes. Go for it.
Sure. Well, like you said, I feel very honored to be part of Baylor College of Medicine and Texas Children's Hospital, because they've really allowed me to, you know, do what I love to do. And one of the things you mentioned, I'm the director of the Trauma and Grief Center at Texas Children's Hospital. And really through that center, we've been able to reach out to the community in ways that have really been necessary given the number of traumas and really tragic events that have happened not only in Houston, but really across Texas. So one of the major things we do is we provide evidence-based assessment and treatment of traumatized and grieving kids between the ages of 7 and 21. And basically, we provide treatment to those kids that need it. We also provide training in the community. So we know that many community clinicians and school-based clinicians want to help kids who've been traumatized or grieving, but may not have had the necessary training to know how to do that. So we do a lot of community trainings where we provide the training itself and then ongoing supervision for a year so that people can feel equipped to handle that. And then we also do research that is really looking at how kids cope after a death of a loved one or after a traumatic event, and what we can do to make our treatments more effective and more efficient for those kids. So we do that locally. And then, as you alluded to, we've also really been trying to go where we're needed the most. And so, of course, after Hurricane Harvey, that was our greater Houston area. But since that time, we've been called upon to do work in other areas where they've had similar tragedies. So, for example, we've been in Puerto Rico helping after Hurricane Maria. We also have been going out to Santa Fe, where we set up a Santa Fe Resiliency Center to help the many traumatized and grieving families after the school shooting there. And now we're also headed into El Paso and Odessa, since the shootings have taken place there. So we're really trying, you know, my goal for 2020 is to really better figure out how we can be everywhere at once. And yeah. I know that's challenging, but, you know, it really seems that, unfortunately, we're needed everywhere.
Yeah. Do you, and this just came to me, do you want this to become the Red Cross of the emotional trauma world? Some type of network that could literally rush in and help communities and help schools that are traumatized in what, unfortunately, our world is being covered with now. But is that the kind of groups that you want to be able to train and be able to go in and help these communities out?
Yeah, you know, I think that that's a great question, and I think that there are sort of different pieces to the puzzle whenever there's been a disaster. So I think Red Cross serves an incredibly important role, and we would never want to take their
right.
place. I think that we can certainly supplement a lot of the work that's being done, and one of my hopes is that we could establish really a disaster response team that specializes in childhood trauma and grief that could be called upon, you know, at any given moment to be able to go out and really provide consultation to the community and empower the community to be able to handle whatever crisis it is. So we don't want to just parachute in and out. We want to be able to equip the people there to be able to provide the treatment that's needed.
So when you do go in, you want to be able to train those people
exactly.
that are going to live there to be able to have continual help. Because, you know, Hurricane Harvey was how long ago? A few years ago?
Yeah.
And
2017.
Yeah. So, and there is still, is there not, and you know more about this than me, aftermath from that hurricane, correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And in fact, we started seeing the most kids, I would say, about a year to 18 months after the hurricane, which is actually consistent with what they found after Hurricane Katrina, that many kids don't even start presenting with symptoms of post-traumatic stress until about a year afterward.
So yeah, I know I'm a generation ahead of you, maybe two, because you're a lot younger than I am. But it seems like in my day, when things happened, mom and dads would always just say, "Oh, the kids, they're resilient, they'll get over it." That's
mm-hmm.
That has caused us to have lots of people walking the streets now that we are in elevators with every day, or Walmarts and things of that order every day, walking around with, that have the aftermath of untreated, unrecognized trauma in their life that they haven't even addressed. And it's more than just kids being resilient. We need to help them through that, and we need to be that buffer.
Right.
And that's what the wisdom that you're finding out and in the research that seems to be a great tool. Okay, so what is the difference? Or first of all, let's just talk about what is trauma and how prevalent is it? And let's just look at the children for a while tonight. What is trauma in a child? What's the different faces it can show up in?
Sure. So a trauma is really an exceptional experience that overwhelms the child's capacity to cope. And a trauma can be subjective. So as adults, we may think that something may not be traumatic, whereas for a child, it may be traumatic. And we know that about half of U.S. children will experience a traumatic event before the age of 18.
Half.
So this is a huge number of children who are exposed to trauma. I think part of the difficulty is that the way that post-traumatic stress presents in children is very different than how it presents in adults. And oftentimes, children who have post-traumatic stress will look like they are hyperactive, for example. So they may be hypervigilant and jumpy because that's part of the symptom picture of post-traumatic stress. But that gets misdiagnosed as ADHD. And I can't even tell you the number of kids. I would say probably 90% of the kids that are referred to our Trauma and Grief Center have already been diagnosed with ADHD, and half of those kids were actually misdiagnosed. So I think part of it is really knowing how trauma presents in children and really asking the right questions. So, you know, we hear from teachers all the time that certain children are behavior problems or they're acting out, and they're asking the question, you know, what's wrong with you? What's wrong with this kid? As opposed to what may have happened to you.
Yes.
And, you know, for the vast majority of kids who truly are, you know, acting out in the classroom and not able to sit still and really, you know, not functioning, many of those kids have been traumatized. So part of what we're trying to do is just raise awareness around what does post-traumatic stress look like in children, how can you identify it, and how can you quickly and appropriately make a referral, because we know the sooner we can intervene with those kids, the better.
And, you know, Doctor, we say that line, and I know I say that line every week on this program. It's not what is going on, what's wrong with you. It's
right.
What has happened to you. And that is such an important byline, because it is. And the ADHD, I think, is very important, because what's a parent do when they have this energy-filled child? They take it to a physician. And I'm not saying physicians are bad. By all means, we work for them, but and
yeah.
You are one. But what do? They give them medication to simmer them down. And that, so not only could they be misdiagnosed, they could be taking medicine that will never, you know, that's not helping the situation whatsoever.
Right.
That's phenomenal. And 50% of all children, more than 50%, up to 18, are going through, have experienced some type of trauma.
Yes.
And
do
you have the same list of trauma as what we use in the ACEs test of like divorce? Do you consider divorce a major trauma in a child's life?
You know, that one is a little bit trickier because that tends to be much more subjective. So
yeah.
If you're talking about an amicable divorce where, you know, both parents are cordial to each other and they're actually, you know, doing what they feel is in the best interest of the children, then typically children don't develop post-traumatic stress from a divorce. But, you know, if there are other factors that accompany that divorce that are traumatic, then certainly, you know, we can see post-traumatic stress. But getting to your question, I do think that most of the traumas we're considering when we talk about children being exposed, half of U.S. kids being exposed, we are talking about ACEs like, you know, the death of a loved one or sexual abuse or physical abuse or witnessing domestic violence. And we actually know that not all ACEs are alike, meaning that certain traumas are more potent than others. And in fact, what we're finding is that bereavement or the death of a loved one is actually the strongest predictor of poor school outcomes and school dropout and school failure above and beyond any other form of trauma that includes sexual abuse, physical abuse, or witnessing domestic violence. And bereavement is not only the most common form of trauma, but also tends to cause the most distress in children. So for that reason, bereavement is actually one of those traumas that we're paying particularly close attention to within our trauma and grief center, because we know that it can have a huge impact later down the road.
Okay, now we're going to dig deep into that because I'm very interested. That's my wheelhouse with deals with bereavement and grief, and I really want to dig deep inside of that. We're going to take our first break, and we're going to come back, and Dr. Kaplow, we're going to look at that bereavement and why it does take such an impact, like you said, maybe even more of an impact than what sexual abuse could have on a child psyche. So I want to discuss that, and we will do that right on the other side of our first commercial break.
HCI Publishing, that brought you the international bestsellers A Child Called It and the Chicken Soup for the Soul series, comes the latest book by Dr. Gregory Williams, Shattered by the Darkness. This book describes the horrific abuse that Dr. Williams suffered at the hands of his father for over 12 years, and the damaging effect of keeping everything silent about that abuse for 30 years. If you're looking for that book that you can't put down, then pick up a copy of Shattered by the Darkness by Dr. Gregory Williams at all Barnes & Noble stores, Amazon, and Books A Million. Now, back to Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams.
All right, welcome back. We have a great guest tonight, Dr. Julie Kaplow with Baylor College of Medicine and Texas Children's Hospital. And we're talking this evening about the work that she does with trauma and children, and we're kind of on the subject of grief. So if you have any questions or comments and you just want to jump in and join us in on the conversation, you're welcome to do that. Call at 888-627-6008. And I'm intrigued, Doctor, that when you were talking to Jane Pauley, correct? That was actually doing the interview with you the other day that I watched. She asked you about childhood traumatic grief. What is childhood traumatic grief? There has to be a difference between regular and normal grief and traumatic grief. So if you can explain that, because there's so many parents out there that think, they'll get over this. But this is something that really needs to be looked at in great detail. That's why I love the work that you're doing, especially in this. So explain to me what childhood traumatic grief is and the difference between normal childhood grief. Mm.
So this is a really new area. So there really has not been very much research that can help us to distinguish between what is a maladaptive or abnormal or traumatic grief response versus a healthy or normal grief response. And it's something that we're actively investigating now. But what we do know is that there can be adaptive grief and maladaptive grief. And what some of my colleagues and I have been looking at is really thinking about grief in a multidimensional way. So it's not just you have traumatic grief or you don't. It's more that there can be different dimensions of grief, and children can be high or low on any of these three dimensions. So, for example, one is separation distress. This is yearning and longing for the person who died. And as you can imagine, that can be very normative within, you know, a certain period of time after a loss. But if we're looking at, you know, 8 to 10 years afterwards and a child is still feeling very stuck and missing the person so much that they can't function, then we know there's a problem. Similarly, we have identity or existential distress in kids where they may feel like, how am I going to live life without this person? Or how am I going to get through my life without them here? And we also have something called circumstance-related distress, where a child may feel like they're very preoccupied with how the person died. So I wish I could have intervened, or I wish there was more that I could have done to save them. But we also know that there are adaptive counterparts to each of those. So with separation distress, the example I like to use is a 9-year-old little girl that I was working with who lost her mother to cancer, and she was devastated and missed her tremendously. But she started to engage in behaviors that she used to do with her mom. So she started to make her mom's favorite apple pie. She started to take swim lessons because that was something her mom loved to do with her. And the more that she engaged in those behaviors, the closer she felt to her mom. So she sort of was able to create a new normal and a very different but healthy connection to her mother. Similarly, with identity distress, we hear kids saying all the time, I don't know how I'm going to live without my dad, for example. But we also hear that same child saying, I want to live the kind of life my dad would have wanted me to live, or I want to live in a way that would have made him proud. And that's the adaptive side of that existential or identity distress. And then finally, with circumstance-related distress, we hear kids saying all the time that they want to make meaning of the death. So they're not exactly saying that, but they're doing that through their behavior. So, for example, I was treating a little boy whose father died in a tragic plane crash. And when I asked him, what do you want to be when you grow up, he said, I want to be an engineer so I can make planes that don't break anymore. And we see kids naturally gravitating toward wanting to change those circumstances into something meaningful to protect other people from what they've been through. So, again, we hear kids saying, you know, I want to be an ER doctor so I can save someone in the way that I wish they had saved my sibling. Or, you know, I want to do A, B, or C because I know this is what would have helped my mom. And so those are the kinds of things that we really try to harness in the treatments that we use. So we're not only reducing the maladaptive grieving, but we're really trying to grow and enhance the naturally adaptive grief that comes with each of those dimensions.
Which it could possibly turn a very negative thing in a child's life into a force of positivity if they can just turn the corner on that grief, correct?
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah. Well, what are some signs that a child may be having the traumatic grief compared to a normal grief cycle? What would be some red flags that a parent would be able to say, oh, wait, this is outside of the realm of normal grief?
Right. So we look at a few things. We look at the intensity of those feelings that I just described and the frequency. And in addition, we look at functioning. So, for example, you know, we may have a child who literally cannot get out of bed in the morning, who refuses to go to school, will say things like, my life isn't worth living now that my mom isn't here, doesn't want to do the things that they used to enjoy doing because doing them without the person is just too painful. So those are the kinds of things when we're seeing significant changes in their daily functioning and their ability to function, that's when we would be concerned and want them to have an evaluation. And again, some of this really is all about the timing because right. within the first 2 to 3 months of a death, a lot of these behaviors are very normative. It's right. when we start to get into, you know, 6 months to a year later, we want to start to see kind of a diminishing of that intensity.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any other signs? I mean, you know, nightmares would probably be normal. Things of that order. Maybe possibly images of the person that had passed away. So after 2-3 months, those things mm-hmm. should start fading to the side,
yeah,
right? They ought to.
Right. So I think that with the, you know, so what we were just talking about was sort of signs that someone may be grieving in a maladaptive way. What we also know is that if the death occurred under traumatic circumstances, where it was either, you know, for example, a homicide or a suicide, mm-hmm. oftentimes in addition to that maladaptive grief, you can have post-traumatic stress. So on top of their grieving, you can see children who do have nightmares and who are hypervigilant and who are re-experiencing the event over and over again or having flashbacks. So that's why oftentimes when the death is under tragic and traumatic circumstances, it's really like a double whammy for those kids. We're not only dealing with their sorrow and their sadness and their grief, but we're also dealing with their post-traumatic stress.
Mm-hmm. How about those, the evil twins that I call them in my book, guilt and shame? Does that play mm-hmm. any part in the child's dealing with this traumatic grief?
Absolutely. So I would say that most often when we're helping children who've experienced the death of a loved one due to suicide, mm-hmm. there's often a lot of guilt and shame and remorse around that type of death, particularly around stigmatized deaths is when we really start to see a lot of that. Besides suicide, we also see that with a drug overdose, for example. And so that's a whole other area where we really need to intervene specifically to alleviate some of that guilt and remorse and regret.
Mm-hmm. Any paranoia? Is it normal to be paranoid that the entire world is an unsafe place to be?
Yeah. And, you know, in fact, what we find is that oftentimes after a tragic death, kids will start to have a different worldview. So they will start to say to themselves, you know, the world is a dangerous place, bad things can happen. And that's also something that we actively try to target in the treatments that we use, because obviously we want kids to be able to live healthy, happy lives and know that, you know, even though this horrific event did happen, they can still go on to lead productive lives. So changing their thinking is a big part of what we do in the treatment.
Okay. How about schoolwork? Do you see that can be a temporary decrease in activity and dropping of grades and things started going downhill? But sometimes it could plummet at this point. Yeah.
Well, and that's a really good point. And actually, that's why one of the areas that we're really trying to target in terms of raising awareness is with the schools. And we've actually started a brand new program called Handle with Care that I first heard about it in Michigan. But the program is really designed to link police officers with schools. And the way that it works is that when a police officer goes to a scene of a crime where a death has occurred, whether it's homicide or suicide, or whether a child actually witnessed a death, he then immediately alerts the school principal that this child was, you know, here at the scene when the death occurred. The principal then tells the child's primary school teacher, and the teacher monitors 5 different behaviors that we've trained them to look for. And if they notice any of those behaviors in the child in the next 3 months, then they're referred to us for treatment. So what it's really doing is it's actually helping law enforcement to become more trauma and grief informed. It's also helping the schools to become more trauma and grief informed, and it's getting the kids the early intervention that we know is so important, because oftentimes, as you can imagine, especially in our underserved communities, kids are sent back to school, you know, the day after they've witnessed their cousin being shot to death, and no one knows about it, you know, and everyone expects that child to just behave normally in the classroom. So our school teachers are so critically important to be able to help inform and to really identify those kids as early as possible to get them the treatment that they need.
Yeah, my guests the last 2 weeks have been Sue Fort White from Nashville, and she has helped implement Handle with Care is what their program is. We talked about it last week on the show about the police officers, and they have an awesome website on the Nashville Handle with Care of how they literally go into the schools and help each other out with the children that have gone through traumatic events. And it's awesome. Are you possibly going to be at the Trauma Sensitive School Conference in Atlanta next month?
You know what? I'm not going to be there, but I do want to say that the San Antonio group that is doing Handle with Care has been incredibly helpful to us in launching the same program here in Houston, and we're actually starting with Pasadena. But the San Antonio group has been incredibly helpful to us, so shout out to them.
That's wonderful. I'm looking forward to this because I believe it's the largest trauma-sensitive school conference. I'm speaking at it, I believe, February 16th, 17th, and 18th. And I'm looking forward to that. And anything that I can do to help locally, I would love to be involved in that because I think this is a key to be able to help everybody be part of it because this trauma-sensitive communities is what our world has to go to.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Yeah. What then can you do if you're a parent and you're listening to the show tonight to help a child besides, you know, call you and get an appointment, but to help their child with traumatic grief? What's some of the things that just some little helpful tips that they can actually be alerted on, but then be able to help the child with,
right?
As a parent.
Yeah. So I think that for grief in particular, there are a range of support services available. We have a wonderful community partner in Bose Place, and they offer peer support. And one of the nice things about that is that it's not an intervention per se, but it's very validating for children to be around others who've experienced similar types of losses. So these are all groups where kids can feel supported by other kids that have had a very similar experience. Again, certainly they can make a referral to our Trauma and Grief Center. But also for most children who experience the death of a loved one, under most circumstances, they will be resilient and they will be okay with support from family and friends. So it's not as if every child who has experienced the death of a loved one is going to need a psychosocial intervention. But again, the signs and symptoms to be looking for are really focusing on the functioning of the child. So if a parent, you know, and the parent knows best because they're the expert on their child, but if they're seeing real dramatic changes in the child's behavior, if they're unable to do the things that they used to enjoy doing, if their school grades are dropping, if they're having difficulty with peers, you know, any of those things could really necessitate an evaluation. And what I also say is to parents is you really want to make sure that wherever you're going to be evaluated, that they're using standardized, valid assessment tools. We know that there are many well-intentioned clinicians out there that may not be using those types of assessments, but really it's so important because that is the only way that we as clinicians can really ensure that we're treating the kids who really need to be treated. And if we're just kind of sending kids to clinicians who are just kind of eyeballing the child and talking to them for 5 minutes and then making a judgment about how they're doing, that's really not best practice. You want to make sure that wherever you send your child, that they're using, again, assessment tools that have been validated for that particular population of children.
Is that where you come up with the phrase, that evidence-based
assessment? Exactly.
Yeah. And that's exactly important.
So it's very important, and especially in the field of grief where, you know, really, there hasn't been a gold standard for how to measure maladaptive grief in children. So one of the assessment tools that we use is one that has recently been validated among children in the Houston area, as well as kids across really different parts of the U.S. in urban areas, in suburban areas, and also in more remote areas, just to make sure that those items really map on to what children actually experience after the death of a loved one and can identify those kids that really do need a higher level of intervention.
Well, that's fantastic. And we're going to take our last break, but when we come back, I want to kind of scrape inside a little bit on the Santa Fe school shooting and the aftermath of that, what you've done there, and the programs that you have established now there with several people, I think, on your team, possibly, that's working inside that community. So we'll talk about that just on the other side of this break, and we'll be back in about a minute and 7.5 seconds on Breaking the Silence.
TI Publishing that brought you the international bestsellers, A Child Called It, and the Chicken Soup for the Soul series, comes the latest book by Dr. Gregory Williams, Shattered by the Darkness. This book describes the horrific abuse that Dr. Williams suffered at the hands of his father for over 12 years, and the damaging effect of keeping everything silent about that abuse for 30 years. If you're looking for that book that you can't put down, then pick up a copy of Shattered by the Darkness by Dr. Gregory Williams at all Barnes & Noble stores, Amazon, and Books A Million. Now, back to Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams.
Thank you, Douglas. Appreciate that. We're with Dr. Julie Kaplow with Baylor College of Medicine and Texas Children's Hospital. And Doctor, I think the TAG group that you have established and the trauma and grief, you have three different things that you're dealing with there, I believe, if I remember reading everything right on that, that you actually do the treating for the 7 to 21-year-olds, and then you have large-scale training. But then you also deal with research. What kind of research are you working on right now, if you can kind of just let us inside of those rooms, just briefly, that you're excited about in this area of your expertise?
Sure. So we do have an amazing team within the Trauma and Grief Center of researchers and clinicians. And one of the things that I think helps our research to be so relevant is that we really use a scientist practitioner model, meaning that our clinicians sit in on our research meetings and our researchers sit in on our clinical team meetings, and we really feed off of each other. So there's a real synchrony between the two, the research and the clinical, and because we really want the research that we're doing to directly inform how to better treat these kids, and we also want our clinical wisdom to, you know, infiltrate the research that we do. So a number of the projects that we're working on now include looking at, you know, different measures that we're still trying to adapt for different populations of children. So one of the populations that we're very focused on right now are our immigrant youth who've experienced multiple traumas, multiple losses. There has really not been a lot of validating of assessment tools for that population. So we really want to make sure that we're accurately capturing, you know, the kids that need us the most in terms of their post-traumatic stress, their maladaptive grief. So we're looking at validating assessment tools with that group. We're also looking at the longitudinal impact of the death of a loved one under different circumstances. So looking at the long-term impact of homicide, the long-term impact of suicide. We're also looking at how to help children who've been exposed to a school shooting. And unfortunately, as you know, this is an area that has not really been studied, and this is something that we're really trying to better figure out is how do we identify those kids as early as possible who are going to need our help after being exposed to something like this, and how do we make sure that we're using the most effective treatments? So another major area of research that we're really focused on is looking at the effectiveness of one of our treatments called trauma and grief component therapy with different populations of kids who've been exposed to either school shootings, hurricanes, other types of traumas, where oftentimes these kids have had lots of trauma and loss even before the event itself. So we're dealing with a history of trauma or loss, and then on top of that, you know, a horrific event like a hurricane or a school shooting. So really looking at how do we make sure that the treatments we're using are effective for those kids.
That have different layers of trauma instead of just this being the first trauma event in their life. Yeah, that's fascinating. You know, I believe there are still aftermath from like Columbine kids mm-hmm. from that school that went through that horrific event. That kind of was, even though there were shootings before that, but that was the largest at the time and the one that I think got most notoriety. There's still students from those classrooms that are committing suicide now because they never, God forbid, got the right help that they needed at the time. So with that, turning the corner of that, tell me a little bit about what you have going on in Santa Fe and the group that you have there after the shooting that took place there in the school.
Yes. So we do have a wonderful team who, you know, who are part of our Trauma and Grief Center, who spend most of their time out in Santa Fe providing treatment to both children and adults who've experienced trauma and loss related to the shooting. And, you know, this is a community, the Santa Fe community, we've really fallen in love with them. They are so resilient and really have embraced us being there. I think that a lot of that has to do with, you know, being part of Texas Children's Hospital and Baylor, that they felt that they could trust us. And really what we're doing now is identifying those kids that are still needing more help. And believe it or not, many of them are just now approaching, you know, approaching us, the Trauma and Grief Center, to say, I'm still struggling, even though, you know, it's been about a year. But, you know, one of the things that we're doing is we are doing both individual therapy, you know, with the kids at the Resiliency Center. We're also doing group-based therapy with some of the kids in Santa Fe High School. And we've also been doing groups with some of the parents of children who died in the shooting, as well as a number of the teachers who were exposed to the shooting. So we are, you know, one of the other things that we've really recognized is that to go into a community like Santa Fe, you really need to become part of the community and really listen carefully to what they need. And this was a community that was not only devastated by the loss, but, you know, there was a lot of stigma around seeking mental health care in that community. And so helping to normalize post-traumatic stress in that environment mm-hmm. was key, helping them to understand that it would actually be abnormal to not have post-traumatic stress if you were in the room where the shooting took place, and to help them understand that post-traumatic stress is not something that you just get over, that it does often require the assistance or help of a therapist to get past that. But we have some wonderful people out there doing amazing work, and, you know, we really could not be doing this without the help of those people through the TAG Center.
Yeah, and I think there may be some of those folks listening tonight, so my hat off to the you folks and the work you're doing. You're champions of what you're doing for that community, and I applaud you, so thank you for that. Do you feel, Doctor, that the stigma of mental health is kind of getting pushed to the side now, because it seems like everybody has some kind of issue? It doesn't seem like it's that baggage anymore of, oh, we have a mental health issue. No, we all have. I mean, you're talking mm-hmm. about 50% of the children deal with some kind of trauma. There's all kinds of people my age and your age, because I think post-World War II people, their households, what happens in this house stays in this house, and we're not going to talk about it. Now we're walking the streets of going, you know, after me being 30, 35 years silent on what I went through, mm-hmm. I'm just now living. And as I'm going out speaking like you are, maybe you're finding the same thing, that people are starting to line up saying, hey, I need help. I have issues when I get home by myself or in a room alone. And I really think the research that you're doing and the communities and the schools and the police officers are starting to maybe embrace that we all have issues and we all need to stick together and understand that.
And, you know, I think you're absolutely right. And I think that one of the things that has actually helped to shed light on the impact of trauma is the fact that we've had so many traumas, you know, within the greater Houston area. So even after Hurricane Harvey, I saw a real change in how people were approaching mental and behavioral health. The idea that, you know, many, many people did experience the trauma of Harvey, and that it became something that was not so abnormal, that it was actually something that many people experienced. So I think, believe it or not, the silver lining of having that happen here is that I think it definitely raised awareness about the impact of trauma on children in particular.
Yeah, I applaud what you're all doing, because I think that large-scale training that you're trying to implement with trauma and grief with children needs to, and I've said this, and I say it almost every week or two, that our schools should be for the kids during the day, and it should be for the adults during the evening. And we need to have classes and sessions and workshops and things that are available for the community at all times to talk about this kind of trauma, grief at a workshop, ACEs. Oh, man, we could spend 6 months on workshops on just ACEs. And, you know, the kids of what they're going through in the last couple minutes is bullying. Something that we didn't really have. We had it as a kid, but we kind of barreled through it. But it's become different nowadays. Do you have any kind of areas that you're working at with the bullying issue with what the kids are going through now?
Absolutely. Yes, we actually have a number of children and families coming in reporting that it is bullying that is sort of the traumatic event for them that they've experienced. And you know, I do think it's gotten a lot worse. I think especially with social media, we're seeing a lot of that. And we're seeing, unfortunately, links to high rates of suicidal ideation and even suicidal behavior related to bullying. So it's something that we're actively trying to target in the schools, because it's obviously having a major impact on children.
Yeah, we have just a couple minutes left, but how important... I know the answer to this, but I want to hear what you think about it. How important is it to have one champion, one adult buffer in a child's life to be able to give them the solid foundation that a child needs? How important is that in your mindset when you deal with kids and their grief and trauma?
Yeah, I think that's critically important. And I'm glad that you said it that way, because it really does only take one person, believe it or not, to change the trajectory of a child who has been exposed to trauma or loss. And so, you know, and you never know, you may be that one person who is able to assist a child where they don't know, you know, where else to turn. But we've heard time and time again from kids who've come through our doors that, you know, if it weren't for my gym teacher, if it weren't for my uncle, if it weren't for, you know, the priest, whoever it is, helping me, I wouldn't be here today. So I think, you know, that one person can make all the difference.
Yeah, I know my aunt and uncle were my savior. If it wasn't for them, I would not even be close to being around. They just helped me so much. We have 1 minute left, Dr. Kaplow. How does people, if they need help, how do they get in touch with these organizations and the things that you're working on? And if they need resources right now to be able to tap into and talk to somebody or get in touch with you, can you tell them how to be able to do that?
Yes. So people can go to our Trauma and Grief Center website. If you just Google Trauma and Grief Center, it will pop right up. So it's Trauma and Grief Center at Texas Children's Hospital. And on that website, we have how to make an appointment. We also have a resource page where we have different handouts for parents, for teachers. We also have information about upcoming trainings that we're doing. And for anyone who's also interested in more of the academic side, I have a website that people can go to if they Google my name, Julie Kaplow, and academia. It will pop right up, and you can download any of the papers that we've worked on, and that includes a lot of the research that we talked about tonight.
Okay, fantastic, fantastic. Well, Dr. Kaplow, thank you. It was an honor to have you with us tonight, and if it's all right, I may... have you come back and we'll, because we didn't even scrape the surface. I'd love to hear more from you. But thank you so much for spending the last hour with us, and it was an honor to have you this evening.
Sure. Thank you so much. It was an honor to be here.
Hey, thank you, Doctor. Just want to let everybody know before we close that we, no matter what you've been involved with and what's going on in your life, as long as there's breath in you, there's always that opportunity for hope. So always hang on to that. May this year just be a year that you strive to be even more of a person that what you were meant to be. Try to get over what's going on in your life and just never give up on that one word of hope. We want to thank you for joining us tonight for Breaking the Silence. And next week, 8 o'clock Central Time right here every Sunday evening for another edition. We'd love to have you join us. Another edition of Breaking the Silence. God bless and have an awesome week.
Thank you for listening to Breaking the Silence with Dr. Gregory Williams. To contact Dr. Williams, dial 832-396-6525 or email him at shatteredbythedarkness@gmail.com. And don't forget to join us each Sunday night at 8 p.m. Central Time, 6 p.m. Pacific on BBS Radio Station 1. For the next episode of Breaking the Silence.